Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. Appropriately, since we're on the radio, we're going to talk about the present and future of radio today with Paul Allen, who is an associate professor in the Department of Recording Industry here at MTSU. He's in his post-retirement period. That's what the Tennessee Board of Regents likes to call it. Mr. Allen is the author of Artist Management for the Music Business, which is now in its third printing. He's also a contributing author to the Industry Guide from Demo to Delivery and co-author of the defining recording industry book entitled Record Label Marketing, which is now in its second edition, and his personal website is paul-allen.com. Thanks for being with us today, Paul.
Jenna, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for dealing with me while I took off my glasses in order to read that. Let's start out with a quote from a guest column that you wrote for the Tennessean. It appeared in their December 16th edition, and it goes as follows. While Arbitron says people over 18 years old listen to 15 hours of music on traditional radio each week, Nielsen recently reported the number is more like 9 hours per week. Not good news for advertisers and not surprising news to the music business. Why is this happening?
Arbitron is an industry organization to which radio stations subscribe, and what Arbitron is doing is they're measuring the audience for every station in America, including WMOT. But they'll measure the audience size, and why that's important and why you'd want to hire a company to do that is because your advertising rates are based upon how many ears you have listening to your radio station during certain parts of the time period, during the week, during the day. It's broken down into quarter hours and other day parts. But so they're the company that radio stations pay, and they're the only company that does this, pay to determine how many listeners they have, which then determines how much advertising they make. To underscore the importance of this, in Los Angeles, the country radio station that was in Los Angeles at the time, which was KZLA, they changed their formats, but KZLA had 2.1% of the radio audience in Los Angeles during the average quarter hour. So in the average 15 minutes, 2.1% of everyone who has a radio on in Los Angeles is listening to KZLA, 2.1. If that audience had gone up from 2.1 to 2.2 of the Los Angeles audience, that would mean $1 million more a year in money to that radio station in Los Angeles. So it kind of gives you a sense of how important Arbitron is. So Arbitron says one thing. They're saying that there's just been slight declines in the number of people who listen to radio today. In 2009 was their last report. But Nielsen, the people that do the a lot of things, one of the things that they do is they measure television audience ratings. They've also done some ratings work for radio. And they report about half as many people listen to radio as what Arbitron is reporting. So I don't know who is right or who is wrong, but clearly there's something that's not connecting in the way that these folks are measuring audiences.
Because of the technological devices used by Arbitron, diary holders is what they used to be called, people who tell you how often they're listening to the radio for Arbitron's benefit of their data processes. It's more precise than it was back in the 60s and 70s when nobody in the radio industry, and I mean nobody, regardless of their ratings, agreed that the Arbitron ratings were a true measure of the listening audience.
And that's absolutely true. In fact, I'm sure a number of the people who are listening to the program this morning remember the times when Arbitron would send them randomly a white booklet, which was a diary. It had maybe 20 pages in it. And they expected listeners, radio listeners, to write down the every station that they listened to. Mm-hmm. And they would send along maybe a couple of dollars to make you feel guilty if you didn't fill out the thing. And then you mail it back to Arbitron, and Arbitron would dump this into a database, and they would report it back to the radio station. Today, there's a new, relatively new device called the personal people meter that Arbitron is using, and what it does is it listens to everything you listen to on the radio, as well as a television, too, as it turns out. And what happens is families will agree to be a personal people meter families for a period of 2 to 3 years for Arbitron, and they pay them a certain amount of money, but Arbitron has never quite told people how much they paid. But what this thing is it's a device about the size of a pager, and you carry it on your person, on your belt or somewhere like that, all day long. At the end of the day, you drop it into a little device. It looks like an iPhone or iPod charging device. You just sit it on there, and it uploads everything you've listened to during the day. And so it's an extremely accurate reflection of what people listen to.
So Nielsen is not using similar technology in its methodology?
The report I saw didn't tell me how they came to their conclusion. I have to think that perhaps that they used surveys, but I don't know what theirs was based on. And since Nielsen is not a company that typically reports audience sizes for radio, it's unclear to me what they used. But Nielsen's a pretty credible company, and so whatever they use to back up their claims, I'm sure will be relatively credible. It's just that there are two very different measures or reports about how big the audience is that listen to traditional radio.
Now, there was a letter written to the Tennessean in the December 22nd edition that was a response to your editorial from Mr. John Lomax III of Nashville, and some of the things he bring up are some of the things that I, as an ex-DJ from days of yore, have been feeling about radio contributing to its own problems by extracting a great deal of the personality out of it, putting tight reins on their DJs, making them just read what's on liner cards instead of being more individualistic, having tighter playlists, exposing less new music on the air, fewer new artists, failing to take that chance. I wonder if you think that all of those things are true, and is there a way to empirically prove that they have contributed to people punching out and going elsewhere for their entertainment?
I agree with many of the things that Mr. Lomax mentions in his response. Radio stations. Let me go back historically for just a minute to explain why things are the way they are today.
Sure.
The Telecommunications Act of 1996 deregulated the broadcast ownership to where owners could own a handful of stations, and when the Telecommunications Act passed, an attachment to that bill allowed essentially broadcasters to acquire as many radio stations as they wanted, provided that they didn't take on more than 25 or 30% of the listening audience in any particular market. And that was because they didn't want one radio group or organization to control the thinking and the ideas that come through radio by just a handful of companies. They want to have diversity of opinion in the marketplace. But in fact,
deregulation has brought about a situation where they can own multiple radio stations, television stations, and print entities
absolutely.
In the same market.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. And not only that, they own a radio station, and with HD Radio, suddenly they own three radio stations for every one that they used to own if they want to begin broadcasting in HD, but that's a whole different thing. Mm-hmm. So you have a few companies owning a lot of stations. For example, Clear Channel, they own 1,000 stations across the country, mostly large stations. And in Nashville and in most markets, you'll find that they own 4 to 5 radio stations, control 25 to 30% of the listening audience. And whatever it is that a advertiser wants to advertise, they have a listener demographic in one of those 4 or 5 stations that will fit exactly what the advertiser wants. So it works well for the companies. But Clear Channel and Citadel, which is now bankrupt, and Cumulus and others are in serious trouble before deregulation, before the consolidation of the industry, radio stations were selling for about 8 times of their annual cash flow. You just look at their annual cash flow, 8 times, that was going to be the price of the station. What these companies were doing to acquire and grow their groups, they were paying 20 times cash flow. So in the short term, they did well, but in long term, where we are now, that they severely overpaid for the radio stations.
A great deal of debt service.
Although it was different this time, before 96, debt was oftentimes with hometown banks because there were hometown radio stations. This time through, investors provided a lot of the capital to finance them. And to give you an idea about how challenging it is right now for the radio stations, almost all the major radio groups, their stock prices have been selling for a dollar, sometimes less than a dollar over the last few months. The economy has something to do with it, yes, but they're there are huge expectations of the radio stations, and so what they do is they reduce the amount of music that they play and increase the amount of advertising that they play.
So you could have a stop set on radio, a commercial cluster that is 4 or 5 minutes long easily.
Sure. To give you an idea, pre-deregulation, you could expect 8 to 10 units per hour, meaning 30-second or 60-second commercials. You and I remember those days because we were both announcers before.
My program directors usually wanted to limit the commercial cluster to 3 minutes because he said anything more than that, and he's afraid the audience will punch out.
Exactly, yep. And so today, it's 20 units an hour, especially during drive time, which is in the morning and the afternoon when people are traveling to and from work, 20 units an hour. And so you try to find the music in there, and there isn't nearly as much as there was. On the other hand, people are somewhat frustrated with the lack of music and the amount of commercials, and so they've migrated to talk radio. And so about 18 to 20% of the listening audience nationwide, they don't listen to music anymore. They listen to Rush Limbaugh and others like him.
Those programs are cheap to produce.
Absolutely.
Bottom line is, yep. It doesn't cost you very much to put somebody on the air and let them gab or discuss something with a sidekick or somebody that they've got a telephone connection to. Mm-hmm. You don't have to pay a whole lot of personnel in order to take care of that.
Yep.
With regard to Clear Channel and the corporatization of radio after deregulation, does it not also strike you that one of the problems was that the corporate headquarters and whatever chain, just not just Clear Channel but other chains, would issue directives out of corporate headquarters and try to go for a homogenous sound with different radio stations in each and every market, and they tried to put what was, you know, going, if you've got a radio station in Walla Walla that's successful, let's see if we can replicate it in Amarillo, regardless of the fact that the cultures in Amarillo and Walla Walla and the people who live in those different cities are a totally different in their attitudes, in their demographics. This homogeneity just doesn't seem to work, as far as I'm concerned. You lose the community flavor if you're not in touch with the city you're supposedly trying to attract to your station. Am I off base, or what do you think?
Let me give you a sense about how close you are on track. First off, I'm friends with a lot of program directors across the country. I used to run a trade association for the radio industry, and so I know a lot of programmers. And while it's true programming has somewhat become centralized, a lot of programmers still are given a certain measure of freedom to be sure that they're adapting what they're playing to a local audience, because an audience in Dallas is way different than an audience in Seattle, even in the same radio format. So they're given some measure of freedom with that. But a friend of mine named Larry Wilson used to own Citadel, and he sold it about 8 years ago. And he walked away with $56 million, went back to his ranch in Montana, and these people who bought his stations paid a lot of money for them. So now Larry's getting back into the radio business. He'd been out of the radio business until about 6 or 8 months ago. And now he's going back buying radio stations. There was one, for example, in Portland, Oregon, that he bought. Paul Allen, not this Paul Allen that you're speaking to this morning.
But, different Paul Allen.
Yeah, the guy who was Bill Gates' business partner who owns most of Seattle. Larry Wilson bought a radio station from Paul Allen. Paul Allen paid $41 million for it in 1999. Larry Wilson bought the very same station back from him for $11 million about 2 weeks ago. And what Larry's going to do is he's going to take the stations that he's buying and make them very, very local, which goes to your point that when you hear a morning team or an afternoon team or midday or even overnights, it's not somebody who is recorded or who's being piped in from some station on the East Coast who's being aired in Portland. Instead, it's Larry's announcing staff, and they're very closely connected to the community. They're going to serve the community in ways that they haven't been for the last 10 years. And he's doing this with each station that he's buying. So he's going back to the traditional ways of radio 30 years ago, which is locally based, very closely tied to the community, and serving the community, especially in times when there are weather and tragedies and things like that. So Larry's got the right idea, and it goes right to where you're at, is that people, it's not local anymore. I mean, it's hard to even get the local weather on a local radio station. So
I mean, regardless of what music format you put on, that seems to be the very smart thing to do, is to have your radio station embody or try to embody as closely as possible the flavor, the personality of the people who are listening to you. And I think radio stations got away from that when it became not so necessary to do news and public affairs in order to get their licenses renewed by the Federal Communications Commission, because that was de facto public service to the community. That brought you in touch with the community. Something I was wondering about is back in days of yore, the program director used to be able to listen to new releases that the people from the record companies would bring in and just go with his gut as to whether or not he thought that was going to be a hit. And he would make this decision in conjunction with looking at Billboard and radio and records and whether or not he thought it should be a new ad, as they call it, to the playlist. And then there was the advent of consultants, and everything became a numbers crunching game. Program directors started to feel insulted that their general managers would think that they needed outside help from somebody who doesn't even live in the market to try to tell them what music should go on that station to attract that audience. So where do we stand in the radio business today with the use of consultants? Is it more pronounced than ever, less pronounced? Where is it going?
It's pretty much the same. And the reason I say that is while program directors like to make people think that they, and I'm not speaking for all program directors, but some program directors are perfectly fine having consultants in their midst, helping guide them for what their local audience ought to have. Let me go back to my example about KZLA. A friend of mine named R.J. Curtis programmed KZLA when it was country, and his ratings went from a 2.1 down to a 1.9, which means the station lost $2 million that year, and that cost him his job. He was fired.
Yeah.
So what programmers like about having consultants is if you have a consultant come in and they determine what's best for your local audience and it doesn't work, then the program director says, it was the consultant's fault. It wasn't mine.
Uh-huh.
So they actually serve as kind of a buffer between decisions that the programmer may or may not have made. But if they follow the consultant, because the general manager or ownership of the radio group approved hiring of the consultant, what are you hiring them for if you don't take their advice? Take their advice, if it doesn't work, it kind of insulates the programmer from losing their job. So while it's kind of like, please don't throw me in that briar patch.
Yeah.
You know, it's really not such a bad thing. But consultants are still being used, and it's a little different now why they're being used. It's because program directors... the choice of music that goes on the air is probably the sixth or seventh or eighth most important thing they do during the day. You would think that's the most important thing they do. Well, they have a music director. Well, what happens with a music director is instead of music directors actually making choices, what they do is they run interference with the record companies who are trying to reach the programmer to get their music on the air. Because the programmer is in constant meetings, and it's all about bottom line, dollars, 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 bottom line, audience, advertising, promotion. It's all about that, and the programmer is more than ever is immersed in what goes on in that environment, and so music kind of takes a back seat. And so having a consultant there helps with the music, and it also helps with some of the training and the reviews of the on-air talent too, to make sure that someone is providing the talent some feedback. And again, many consultants provide that as a service to radio stations.
Does any general manager ever get fired by a station owner because he hired a consultant who cost the radio station money and his choices were just totally off the mark?
I don't know of any who've been fired for that. I do know that some have been asked to kind of reevaluate their decisions, kind of like here in Nashville. Bud Adams went to Jeff Fisher and says, Jeff, maybe you may want to start Vince Young for this next game and see if that doesn't work out. And it worked out pretty good. So ownership can, you know, provide guidance, and they do a very good job of that. But actually, a GM for a radio station, those are almost non-existent anymore. Instead, it's a cluster manager. As I mentioned, here in Nashville, there are five Clear Channel stations, and there are no GMs per se for each radio station. Yeah. There's one cluster manager, so one person manages five stations, and so one station might require assistance of a consultant. Another one may have a programmer who works at that station that doesn't need that assistance, or maybe what happens is the radio station across town that's playing hip hop, who's your competitor, they may start doing some things on the station that are starting to erode your audience, and your programmer needs some help in figuring out how to combat that. And so you'll bring in a consultant to kind of help you analyze what they're doing, find out what you're not doing, and to then change your own strategy at the radio station. So they may come in for a short term, but again, it's trying to make the station more competitive.
Odd thing it must be for your corporate cousin to be your rival within a market. Must make for some interesting interpersonal dynamics at conferences and things like that.
Well, often what happens is the cluster is going to have four or five different formats. So it won't be a cousin. It'll be somebody else who actually is owned by a different radio group, like in Nashville, that probably 25 signals, radio signals feed Nashville. And so you have Citadel, you have Cumulus, you have CBS, you have a bunch of the major groups are there. And so the likelihood is that your cluster has five different formats, and so the competition is indeed owned by somebody else.
A lot of people are turning to satellite or subscription radio, and Sirius XM is running a highly successful television commercial right now featuring Elvis, Michael Jordan, Richard Pryor, and Howard Stern for pivotal figures in how each of their fields of endeavor has changed for the better or for ill, they would say for the better. But if satellite radio is so fantastic, why did Sirius and XM have to merge? Why could not they have stayed competitors as separate entities and still each been profitable?
They're immensely unsuccessful, and they have been. And I guess a harbinger of what was to come is XM had put together a series of television commercials to launch their service in Dallas and a couple of other markets back in 2001, and the commercials were very creative. The screen opens up and you see coming out of the sky, you see all these stars coming out, you know, all different formats. It's like music raining from the sky. Lots of tall buildings in the back, and this happened in August. Then on September 11th, there were people coming out of the sky, and it just absolutely, well, nothing else needs to be said. The commercials were gone. Their launch was postponed for a lot of reasons, in part because our focus was somewhere else, not on satellite radio.
Right. This is what happens in a more minor way when an airplane crash occurs. Frequently, that particular airline, Delta or Braniff or whatever it is, will immediately yank all of its commercials off the air because it's just in the most dismal taste that you can imagine, even though those commercials were scheduled way in advance of the tragedy. But go ahead.
Exactly. So here you have two satellite companies, Sirius and XM. XM launched first, but literally they launched. Here are two multi-billion-dollar companies. XM launched two satellites from Russia. Sirius launched their own three satellites. Imagine how expensive, imagine the billions and billions it would cost to launch five satellites.
Yeah.
Well, they did. I mean, in most newspaper markets in America, where there are still two remaining, the newspapers share presses. And I never understood why you would want to launch five satellites and not share the satellites. But anyhow, there's some really flawed thinking behind the way that things began. In 1989, when they first got their licenses, did all the research development, launched everything, and they lost money from the very beginning. About a year and a half ago, Sirius and XM merged, and it's because they were both hemorrhaging so much money. Today, Sirius XM has nearly 20 million listeners. 20 million listeners that are paying about $13 a month. You can do the math and see what that means on a monthly or annual basis. It's still not nearly enough to support the cost of this thing.
Howard Stern is still making millions. Is their investment in him worthwhile?
I don't know. I didn't think it was from the beginning, but yeah. But that was just my own thoughts. But
I mean, in terms as a business decision, not in terms of your own personal taste and whether or not you think Stern is scum or whether he's brilliant.
I don't know anybody that's worth as much money, which was $500 million plus. Mm-hmm. You know, ultimately is what it may have been modified since then, since the merger. But to give you an idea about what that's all worth, I checked the price of Sirius XM. It's around 67 cents. This morning.
That's
67
nothing.
Cents for a multi-billion-dollar merged company.
That's awful.
It says that it's that as a model, it's a great service up to a point, but it's just not making money. So the long-term prospects of Sirius XM probably not so great. And then from a radio standpoint, when you figure up the listeners of a of any particular format on Sirius XM. They're equivalent to maybe the size of a radio station, one radio station in a large market. So you know, I say 20 million listeners, subscribers, that's spread across probably 150, 160 different formats, ranging from comedy to news and information to cooking to weather to music and a bunch of other things, too.
Aren't they eventually just going to have to cut down on the number of formats they're able to offer? I mean, would that help them save money? Or is that just a drop in the bucket?
Well, the thing that goes on with this with Sirius XM is that everything you're listening to comes from a single radio studio.
Right.
There are real-life people there. It's not recorded stuff or programmed through computers. There were real-life people in studios.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of real estate involved, a lot of people involved, a lot of licensing involved.
Right.
All the music that flows, every song that's played. And more so now to satellite, if you can, if as a player on a song, if you can prove that you actually played on a session for an Elvis Presley song, then you're entitled to some measure of payment through a sound exchange, which comes from online music, quote, radio, and then also a satellite radio. So there are more expenses that satellite has than what they've had in the past. But it's an interesting service, but you think about when we get into our car today, you know, what do we do? Well, we have our cell phones. We have radio if we want radio. Mm-hmm. We have our MP3 players if we want to use those.
CD players still.
Still have our CD players.
DVD players.
DVD players. You know, it's against the law to have it pop up on your, you know, in the front seat, but it happens.
Some people have TVs in their car.
Have televisions in the car, exactly. And starting this fall, Ford Motor Company has an option. They're going to allow you to put in they're going to have a USB port on the dashboard, and you can plug in a small device. I forgot what they call the thing. But what it does is it turns your automobile into a small Wi-Fi hotspot.
So that you can have a laptop computer in there.
Your laptop or your iPhone or anything. And then you have options like Pandora. The online site where if you run your iPhone through your radio, or if you Wi-Fi through your radio in your car, truck, whatever you drive, you're getting all this commercial free music that's already been customized for you. I say commercial free. There's occasional commercials in there. So there's so many options going right now that are competing with satellite and competing with traditional radio that fast forward 2 or 3 years, it's going to be an interesting time.
What about internet radio? I listen to it all the time at work. It makes for great background noise. I listen mostly to news talk, however, and of course I get it for free. One, is there a way to make people start paying for that as a business model? And two, are people going to be satisfied with the technical quality they get if they want to listen to music on the internet out of those little bitty computer speakers? Are they everybody going to have to buy a Bose radio in order to be able to listen to music on the internet?
Well, actually, some of the speaker systems you can get that plug into the back of your laptop, oh my goodness, they make a really, really good sound.
Then probably out of my price range.
Well, actually, I spent like $35 for a set for my desktop, and it has a nice subwoofer, and it's they're not very expensive, and they really sound pretty good. If you're just sitting right there in a small listening environment, it won't fill a room, but it really makes it sound good.
Wow.
But think about what we've done over the last 10 years, actually the last 5 years. We go to YouTube, and we're okay with these grainy videos. It's not high def, but we're okay with some of these grainy videos if we're sitting there. Music is recorded in 5.1 stereo, which is amazing, just amazing. Most everything is done in CD quality originally. It's a wonderful sound, but we're okay with shrinking and compressing that down to an MP3, which shrinks it down to about 20% of the actual size of the original file. We're okay with that. Mm-hmm. And even think about it, in the car, you get all this ambient noise that's going on around you. Even when you're walking around with earbuds in your ear, there's ambient noise, and we're okay with that. So to your point, you know, we're okay with compromising from the standpoint of what we watch and what we listen to for the sake of convenience, and that's kind of where we are as a culture right now. Doesn't mean we won't swing back that way. I mean, we want high def if we're going to watch 24 and Jack Bauer, but we want to have video on our smartphones, and we're okay if it's grainy and small.
We want access to what's available now. Even if it's not as good as what we're going to get in the future. It's like our grandparents being so thrilled at having a telephone in their home that they didn't mind cranking it up and going, Sadie the operator, get me New York or something. It's exactly. Basically that analogous.
Yeah, exactly.
Paul Allen is in his post-retirement era as a professor of recording industry here at MTSU, and it's been our pleasure to talk with him today about what's going on in the radio business. Thank you for being with us today.
Jenna, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
This is MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at the same time next Sunday. Speaking of technology, don't forget you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.